Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday. Later in the hour, we will do our week in review, and it has been a monumental week with the inauguration of President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. They were sworn in on the same Capitol steps that a mob of pro-Trump supporters forced their way onto, threatening elected officials inside the Capitol just 2 weeks prior. Now, before we talk with you about it, we welcome Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who represents Massachusetts' 7th District, was at the Capitol during the insurrection and watched from afar as the new administration was sworn in Wednesday. She joins us on the line now. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Congresswoman Pressley.
Good to be with you, Tiziana, and Happy New Year.
Hey, Happy New Year to you, too. It is great to have you. I know that you were in isolation for the inauguration due to possible coronavirus exposure, and I do want to talk about that a little bit later. But let's start with the inauguration. You're watching from afar. How did it feel to you?
Well, the inauguration of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, it really marks a historic, critical transition from an administration that has really been defined by cruelty, corruption, callousness, contempt. And so to now have a president and a vice president who will lead with compassion and empathy, I feel relieved, I feel encouraged, and I feel emboldened, you know, emboldened to begin to deliver on the decisive mandate from the diverse coalition of voters that elected them, that made it possible for democracy to breathe another day, to advance, you know, broad progressive policies, and to begin immediately reversing many of the hurt and harms that were caused by the Trump administration.
I'm struck by your use of the word emboldened, because I've known you for years and always considered you to be quite bold. What are you emboldened to now that maybe you weren't 6 months ago?
Well, I was never shrinking in my advocacy, because I represent a vibrant, diverse, dynamic district, but one of the most unequal in the nation, where in a 3-mile radius, life expectancy drops by 30 years from Cambridge to Roxbury. We know the wealth of a Black Boston family is $8, and that of a white Boston household is $247,000. So representing a district like this, 53% people of color, 40% foreign-born, my district has disproportionately bore the impact of many of the draconian, cruel policies and the emboldened rhetoric of this administration. So I was always fighting and I was always going big. I just did not have a thoughtful and committed partner to do that work with. And I believe with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, I'll have that. So immediately, when it comes to the full authority and the power of executive action, what I've been calling for the administration to do is to halt federal executions, you know, to immediately save lives, to cancel student debt. I see that as a racial and economic justice issue, but also one that is necessary for a just and equitable economic recovery from this pandemic. And then also fighting for 2,000 reoccurring cash payments for the next relief package.
What are you hearing back from the administration, especially on those first two priorities, Congresswoman? On the third, we know that the administration has a $1.9 trillion package it's interested in. But what about on those first two issues? Are you finding Biden and Harris to be receptive?
Well, first I want to say they hit the ground running, okay? This administration heeded our calls to reverse the racist and xenophobic policies of the last 4 years. Again, I represent a district that's 40% foreign born. So the fact that by executive action, They made it a priority to restore those crucial protections for DACA, TPS, and DED recipients is worth noting. They also took important steps to combat the climate crisis, the COVID-19 public health and economic crisis, and then something else that I had been calling for, that is extending the national eviction and foreclosure moratorium. So I do want to give credit where credit is due. They have been strong out the gate. These are many of the things that I've been fighting for. We're in ongoing talks about the canceling of student debt. We're in ongoing talks about using executive action to halt federal executions. I am encouraged by the fact that Joe Biden, President Biden, said throughout the campaign that he wants to, that he is opposed to the death penalty. And so in addition to the what I'm calling for by executive action to halt federal executions and to resentence those currently on death row, I've also introduced a bill to abolish the federal death penalty. And I'm doing that in partnership with Senator Dick Durbin. Now that we've regained control of the Senate, he is the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And so I think our chances look good, you know, on those issues in particular. But I'm not going to let up on the pressure with the $2,000 reoccurring cash payments. I know that that is certainly what my constituents need. It's what they deserve. And I'm going to continue to fight for that. We have to go bold, Tiziana, because the hurt is deep. And so our response, both in this pandemic and beyond that, on social, economic, racial, housing justice issues, must be as far-reaching and as bold, as deep as the hurt is. And we have been experiencing unprecedented hurt. So,
you're talking about deep hurt. We have this new hurt in the nation, which is the result of this armed insurrection into the Capitol on January 6th. And here in the greater Boston area, news that panic buttons in your office had been inexplicably removed prior to that insurrection caused a great deal of dismay. And I want to ask you, what agencies have you reported the panic button removal to? Have they given you any answers in investigation yet? And do you have any information if whether those removals were in fact related to the events of January 6th?
Well, it was unnerving to learn later in the day from my chief of staff that those buttons had been removed. That is currently being investigated. And so that investigation is underway. My panic buttons have been reinstalled. But it does beg a larger question, which is why within hours of this violent attack on our nation's capital, seeking to interrupt the peaceful transfer of power, in my capacity on the House Oversight Committee, I began to call for an investigation to know what individuals and agencies may have aided and abetted this violent insurrection. Donald Trump certainly has culpability in inciting this insurrection, which is why I also called early on for his impeachment and removal. So he will forever be the twice impeached president by this Democratic majority-led House. But he's not, he didn't act alone. There are members of Congress who I believe aided and abetted this insurrection by perpetuating this big lie and played a role in inciting this riot. And they should also be taken to account. And so that is why I'm supporting calls for the expulsion of those members. And then we have to thoroughly investigate. So in the House, we sought to impeach and remove Donald Trump. We honored our oath. I'm hoping the Senate will do their same, the same, hold Donald Trump accountable, impeach him so that he is forever barred from running for office again and is held accountable for the role he played in inciting an insurrection. We need to expel these members who contributed to this. They need to be held accountable. And then we need to thoroughly investigate to better understand exactly what transpired and who played a role to ensure that a breach of this level never occurs again. But Tiziana, I have to say this. Donald Trump getting on a helicopter and going away. And at the end of this investigation, we'll have those answers. But white supremacy, you know, for many, the first time they appreciated the threat that white supremacy is to everyone, to American lives and our democracy, was when it came to the steps of the Capitol. And so as committed as I am to ensuring that our Capitol is never breached again, we need to do the work of rooting out the scourge that is white supremacy, because it is a threat to everyone.
Congresswoman, we have limited time. Excuse me just a second. We have a limited time, and while I'd like to stay on the Capitol, I also want to talk with you about the pandemic. I'm so sorry for having to clear my throat. I'm just a little congested today. Shortly after the insurrection, your husband, you noted, tested positive for COVID-19, and you expressed some real frustration and dismay over the refusal of some members of Congress to wear masks. You, he, members of your staff are in isolation. How is he? How are you? How's your staff?
Thank you so much for asking. My husband and my staff are doing great. I want to thank everyone from throughout the Commonwealth who expressed their well wishes. We're certainly, you know, not extraordinary. You know, we're no anomaly. Thousands of families have been directly impacted by this pandemic. And so I want to send my love out to those who are grieving, who've lost loved ones. And I want to send strength to those who are being caregivers to loved ones right now who are battling this virus. But Conan is doing great. Certainly, I was livid myself and my colleagues and my staff and anyone who was in proximity to these anti-maskers who are my colleagues, that they would operate with such callous disregard for human life. So that was...
You then spoke out this week sharply criticizing the rollout of the vaccine here in the Commonwealth. You talked to the Dorchester Reporter, told them that you'd had some concerns for your own safety, but took the vaccine, wanted to signal to others that it was important to do so. What do you think we need to be doing better in the state right now?
Well, first, I want to again thank President Biden for acting swiftly. He heeded my calls along with Senator Warren to prioritize an equitable recovery by signing by executive order calling for, look, I'm inheriting your tickle here.
I know, it's spreading.
You're spreading it by calling for disaggregated COVID-19 data, which I think is really critical to mobilize much needed resources to hardest hit communities. You know, we have not had a national strategy to combat this virus because of the inept previous administration. And their science denials. We have not had a national vaccine strategy. We now have that within 2 days of this administration. But yes, I think it is unacceptable for Massachusetts, which is a healthcare mecca, to rank 29th in the country when it comes to vaccine rollout. And so the process to date is one that has been disorganized and delayed. And I know there are a number of, I think it was 250 healthcare professionals and doctors who submitted a letter to the state as well, saying that we should be prioritizing those hardest hit communities. And I agree. And that's what I've been fighting for from the very beginning, both in our response and in vaccine access. I represent a district that has 15 community health centers. My district has also been hardest hit by this pandemic. And so we must prioritize those communities that have been hardest hit, and we can and must do better. We're a healthcare mecca. We have the infrastructure. It's unacceptable that we would be 29th in the nation.
All right, last question before I let you go. I know you are watching the mayor's race in Boston closely. We have two women of color declared as candidates. If Mayor Marty Walsh is as confirmed as labor secretary, Boston City Council President Kim Janey will become acting mayor, the first woman of color. What are you watching for in the race, and are you considering an endorsement?
Well, first, I want to say congratulations to this son of Dorchester, making history in his own right as the first union rep to serve as Secretary of Labor, and I'm excited to welcome him to Washington and to work alongside him on behalf of working people. I'm overjoyed for my sister in service and former colleague, Kim Janey, you know, for the history that she's making as Boston's first ever Black mayor and woman mayor. And I'm committed to making sure that she is successful as acting mayor, as I partner with all the mayors throughout the Massachusetts 7th Congressional District. And I'm proud to call Councilors Wu and Campbell colleagues and friends for many years. I'm excited about their historic candidacies. You know, what I'm really focused on right now is reversing the hurt and harm that has been caused by the Trump administration for the last 4 years. So working closely with the president, the vice president, our governor, and all the mayors in the Massachusetts 7th to address that. And then making sure that I get direct relief to our families that are hurting in the form of these $2,000 reoccurring cash payments. So those are my priorities right now. So far as the mayor's race, I look forward to a robust campaign that's going to really center critical conversations about the future of our city. And I look forward to seeing how it unfolds. But it's an exciting time, you know, historic and unprecedented in every way.
And that is Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. She represents the Massachusetts 7th District. Congresswoman, great to have you. I hope to have you back again soon, please.
Thank you, Tiziana. Get this woman some chamomile tea, please. Someone.
I'm working on it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Our first African-American, our first Asian-American, and our first woman vice president, Kamala Harris.
What's so proudly we hailed.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
This land was made for you and me.
We've learned again that democracy is precious. Democracy is fragile. And at this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed.
The new dawn blooms as we free it. For there is always light if only we're brave enough to see it. If only we're brave enough to be it.
Sounds from Washington Wednesday featuring the U.S. Marine Corps Band, Senator Amy Klobuchar, Lady Gaga, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, Vice President Kamala Harris, Jennifer Lopez, President Joe Biden, and inaugural poet Amanda Gorman. So is this, folks, a week of new beginnings where the new dawn blooms, a new administration in Washington, COVID numbers ticking down in Massachusetts, phase one of the vaccine rollout fully underway now? Let's talk about it. It's time for our Radio Boston Week in Review. Call and join us. And we're going to start with what we heard from Representative Pressley before the break, how you feel about events in Washington this week. The number is 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let me welcome our panelists now. We have Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester and a political activist, and Jennifer Braceras, political analyst, lawyer, and director of the Independent Women's Law Center. Reverend Mariama, Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you.
To be here.
It's great to have you guys. And if you caught any of the first segment, you know that somehow a frog crawled into my throat right at the beginning of the show. So if I start to cough or choke, you just jump in and talk and we'll make sure the listeners don't have to hear too much scratchiness. Jennifer, I know you didn't hear all of Ayanna Pressley. Reverend Mariama, I think you did. So what I'm going to do is start by getting some reactions from you to what you heard.
Yeah, well, it's always great to hear. She is my congresswoman and also a friend. I think as she highlighted, and I think connected to what you've said, we do have an opportunity. There has been a transition. And at the same time, and I think Congresswoman Pressley raised this, just because we have a new administration doesn't mean that all of our problems have gone away. And I have to be honest that I'm slightly concerned that people will be of the opinion like, oh, okay, great. Well, now we just let the president handle this. And, Donald Trump, I do think was a problem, but I think he, more than anything, he exposed challenges that we have as a nation. And one person, one new administration cannot handle all of those problems. And so we will need to continue as a nation to lean into and continue the work of deciding who we want to be as a country. That doesn't end. So I'm excited. I think there's new opportunities, but still a lot of work.
I'm going to grab some sound from President Biden in his inaugural that's on that point, Reverend Mariama. Here he is calling for unity.
We must end this uncivil war that pits red against blue, rural versus urban, conservative versus liberal. We can do this. If we open our souls instead of hardening our hearts, if we show a little tolerance and humility, and if we're willing to stand in the other person's shoes, as my mom would say, just for a moment, stand in their shoes.
So Jennifer Braceras, a really clear message there about part of his vision of what comes next. I wonder, and that's really building, I think, on what Reverend Mariama was saying. So let me give you a chance to react to that and add any thoughts on that point.
Sure. I could not agree with President Biden more in what he said there, particularly his emphasis on the word tolerance, because unity requires tolerance. It requires tolerance of those with whom we disagree. It requires goodwill, and it requires, frankly, the benefit of the doubt. We have to give our political opponents the benefit of the doubt that the things they want for this country are based on wanting this country to get better, even if we don't all agree on the means, and we often do not agree on the means, that we all want to help our neighbor and help our country. And the problem is that unfortunately, we live in an era where certain viewpoints are silenced, certain viewpoints are not respected, certain viewpoints are deplatformed regularly. And so I hope President Biden means what he says, that he wants to be the president for everybody, that he will reach out to the 74 million who didn't vote for him, and frankly, who disagree with much of his platform, to understand why they might have voted for somebody else, and that he will outstretch a hand and try to find common ground, not just shove one agenda down the throat of the nation.
So listening to you talk there, Jennifer, I found myself thinking you were talking about certain viewpoints shut down, certain viewpoints deplatformed, for example, and I found myself thinking almost anyone in America might argue that you're talking about them. And so I would ask both Jennifer and Reverend Mariama how we develop a common narrative about what's actually happening in the country right now. I think we're all aware that part of our really big challenge is that our interpretation of the world around us depends so much now on the facts that we're exposing ourselves to.
Sure, but let me jump in and stop you and say, I think the problem is a word you use, narrative. Because everybody has their own perspective and their own spin on things. We're never going to have a common narrative. Everybody views things through a different lens. What we have to have is a willingness, as President Biden said, to stand in another person's shoes and to think about why that person's narrative or perspective might be different from our own.
So, Reverend Mariama, I'm going to come back to you, too, because you know, I hear Jennifer's point. I've also heard a lot of angry Americans the last couple of weeks saying, I want accountability first, and I'll stand in someone else's shoes later.
Well, I think this is very challenging because I think that two things that concern me about where we are. One is I do really believe that there are perverse incentives within the political space to actually not choose things that are in the best interest of the wider American public. And so I think it is hard sometimes to have to assume best intentions when it actually can move your political career forward to be not thinking about the whole. And I say that because I think when you look at what happened with the insurrection, that is not just about viewpoints. You had people going into our Capitol with zip ties and weapons looking to take out even our vice president. And so I think
we have
a challenge, but I don't think that that comes out of nowhere. And I don't think that they are just a fringe group. I think that there's a way that we engage with each other that dehumanizes other folks. And the question is, where is that line? And I do believe that happens on both sides of the spectrum. I, however, believe that in the past 4 years, you've seen a ramping up on the right at a little bit of a higher rate than you have on the left in terms of what's happening. So I think either way, the question is, how do we also lean into civility? And I think
let me give you one way we can lean into civility. Certainly, it's, you know, I probably spoke too broadly when I said everyone in the country has the best interests of the whole at heart. Obviously, that's not true on both sides. There are some who don't, and you're right, we saw that with the insurrection on January 6th. I will give you that. But one way we can lean into civility is not to blame the 70 plus million people who voted for Donald Trump for what happened on January 6th. The people who attacked our Capitol need to be held accountable and prosecuted, be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. But not everybody who voted for Donald Trump, not everybody who supported his policies, not everybody who supported one or two of his policies, but not the rest, is responsible for what happened. And what we're hearing now is that they are, that everybody who worked for his administration should bear responsibility. Anyone who cast a vote for him should be responsible. And that is not a way to unify the country. That is not an example of civic discourse. That is an example of demonization. And if that continues, I can guarantee you that this one-party rule we have now in Washington, D.C. will last exactly 2 years and no more.
So I'm going to jump in long enough to put out the phone number, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I knew we'd have a challenging and thoughtful conversation with our panelists, and you are invited to join it. Reverend Maruyama, I'll go back to you for a response, and then there's a thread here I want to pull on to change our focus a little bit. But first you, Reverend Maruyama.
I guess the challenge for me is if that action came out of nowhere, then I wouldn't be upset. But I think there's quite a few of us who said, if you have someone who keeps saying the things that he says, eventually this is what's going to happen. So I think this is where I think there is a fine line around accountability, because I don't think that what happened was shocking. He said these kinds of things pretty consistently for 4 years. And so I guess my question is, are we really against this way of being? You had a guy who, before getting elected, said, I could go shoot somebody in broad daylight and you would still vote for me.
I'm going to give us a little more sound.
You know? Sure.
Yeah, I'm going to give us a little more sound from President Joe Biden. Earlier, I gave us some of his talk about unity. He also stressed that we have to reject misinformation. He was talking about truth. Here he is.
There is truth and there are lies. Lies told for power and for profit. And each of us has a duty and a responsibility as citizens, as Americans, and especially as leaders, leaders who have pledged to honor our Constitution and protect our nation, to defend the truth and defeat the lies.
That was striking in that it did seem like a direct reference to what Reverend Maruyama was just talking about. And I noted with Congresswoman Presley at the beginning of the show today, her talking about the fact that she felt it was important that Republican legislators who carried forward the false idea that the president had actually won the election needed accountability. Jennifer, is there a different level of accountability required of an elected official who signs or swears an oath to the Constitution when it comes to talking about what happened and what the truth is?
Well, look, the ultimate accountability is at the ballot box. That's where the ultimate accountability is. You know, I personally don't appreciate members of the Republican Party repeating over and over again that Donald Trump won the election. He clearly did not. Every Republican lawyer and judge and Secretary of State who has looked at this has said the same. And so, you know, we certainly do need to call people out when they are not telling the truth or when they are fudging the truth for their own political interests. That's for sure. But does that mean that I think certain members of Congress have blood on their hands for the insurrection? I do not. And like I said, the accountability is at the ballot box.
Let's grab
a
call
here. I guess the challenge
for
me, though, is there's been accountability before, and there people voted for segregation. People have voted not to hold people accountable for lynching.
And so what would you do?
I guess what I'm saying is the question for me is at what point do we name a set of higher values and sometimes have to hold ourselves accountable when we do not make the mark?
But what does that look like? What does that accountability look like? I mean, you know, protesting and banging down the door and scaring the family of Senator Josh Hawley, which is actually what happened in response to some of the things he says. That's not
acceptable. I find it unlikely that that's what Reverend Mariamo is saying.
No, of course not. But I'm asking, what does accountability look like to some people, to the mob? And there's a mob on both sides. Accountability looks a lot like terrorism.
Well, there is. I am going to jump in here because there is. And again, Jennifer, this is part of the reason I framed the question the way I did. There are supporters of the president, the current one and the past one. But there are people who held constitutional offices who subscribed to accountability mechanisms by swearing to those constitutional offices. Mm-hmm. And that does seem like it is a categorically different conversation about accountability in this moment.
Sure, but you also have to realize that people have a right to have a difference of opinion, and certainly
there comes a point though where it's not about opinion.
Please let me finish. I believe you're right. I believe, you know, it's clear that Joe Biden won this election. I also believe that there are some people who are honestly and genuinely concerned with voter fraud. I didn't hear particular senators saying that they thought Donald Trump won the election. Donald Trump certainly said that, but the senators didn't say that. What the senators said was they wanted to object to these electors and to these electoral ballots in order to raise awareness about voter fraud. Now, they have a First Amendment right to have that opinion, and they have a constitutional right to express that opinion as a member of Congress. So I'm not defending their actions. I'm not saying I agree with their actions, but I don't believe that there should be retribution for those actions.
I guess, right,
back to Reverend
Mariamo. The question is, where is the line at which we say no?
I want Reverend Mariamo to have a chance now.
Electoral fraud, then why didn't they raise it in all the states? They only raised electoral fraud in states where Joe Biden won. Only. So if it was about a general concern about electoral fraud, then they would have gone searching everywhere across the country. You can't tell me that only states, if electoral fraud exists, it only happens in states where Joe Biden won. And so I think that the reality is they scored points with some base of people by playing into the president's delusions. And I guess where I'm concerned is, and I have many Republican friends who call a spade a spade. We don't always agree on how to address issues, but we can start from a place of facts. And I get there are always points where it's fuzzy, but there are a group of people who participated in perpetuating, I think, many of what they knew to be a lie because it was more politically advantageous. And I think that is a dangerous place, no matter who is participating in it.
Well,
so here's where I think we are. And I'm going to have to...
All 100 members of the United States Senate, every word out of their mouth, every action they take is based on politics. There's no question about that. I'm not here to defend the actions of any particular members of the Senate. I'm not here in a political capacity. I expressed to you right from the beginning that I don't share their opinions, Senator Cruz or Senator Hawley's opinions on the election or on what their role was in terms of the electoral count. So I don't share their views. I'm not here to defend them. I'm simply here to say that retribution against those we disagree with isn't the American way.
So here's where we are. I feel like what we're getting the benefit of in the conversation the two and you are having back and forth is the sort of the microcosm of the thoughtful national conversation that we are and have to be engaged in right now. And I think you just demonstrated that. I am going to have to go to a break in a minute. But what I want to do in the process of you guys talking, lots of callers wanted to join you. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a second here, have Jennifer Braceras and Reverend Mariama hold on. We're going to go out on a couple of calls so we get some caller voices here, and then we'll go to a break. And when we come back, we do have more subject matter to talk about. So I'm going to shift gears, not because we're done here, but just there's more. And because this is a conversation we are going to continue to have, I am confident, throughout 2021. So let's pick up Nancy from Copley Square. Nancy, go ahead.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I agree that the insurrection should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, and I also hold both parties to blame for their rise, because over decades we knew that the white supremacists and the Nazi party had been amassing weapons in training camps, and no one has done anything about it. We would never allow Antifa or the Black Panthers or anybody else to amass the weapons they were allowed to amass, to have the training camps, to have the to promote their propaganda. So we have never, ever stopped them. And so no surprise, surprise, when Donald Trump gave them an opportunity, they took the opportunity to try to overthrow our government. Thank you.
So, Nancy, I appreciate that call. Let's go now to Tom in Medford. Tom, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. My main concern with the whole conversation about accountability is in line a lot with what the Reverend was saying. The senators that were perpetuating the lie, the big lie that the election was stolen, that it was fraudulent, they know that that's not true. And the fact that we're trying to ask for unity, they are now trying to ask for unity in this moment when we can't even agree on the fact that the truth that the election was not fraudulent is very concerning. And there's no unity there because one side is operating in a completely different universe than the other. So, all right, that's all I have to say.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate that. I want to get one more call here. Let's hear from Dave in West Roxbury. Dave, go ahead.
Well, I guess I'm going to be the I was going to say, nothing gets solved until you solve the pandemic. Until COVID is over, nothing can even start to go back to what needs to be done. And Biden has a chance, but until he solves that. And now, here's truth and lies. Biden and all of the people who are in the top of the Democratic Party are saying the vaccine is safe. All right? Is that truth? Because a lot of people, a large segment of a minority population, think that that's not the truth. So which one are they going to listen to, the Democrat Party and Joe Biden, and take the vaccination when it's time for them to take it? Because so far, all the indications are that some won't. So what's
okay? So I appreciate that, Dave. So I'm going to take it back from Dave. I'm going to say a couple things. A large number of members of Congress of all races and parties have received the vaccination. And I will say that we are committed, because the science has demonstrated for us in trials, et cetera, to continuing to communicate here on Radio Boston that the vaccine is safe. Every guest we've had of knowledge, of medical knowledge, people who have received it themselves have said so. But Dave transitions us, because that's more of what we're going to talk about. And the waters are running deep in our Week in Review this week with Jennifer Braceras of the Independent Women's Law Center and Reverend Mariama White Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Before the break, we were having a conversation about Washington, the inauguration, unity, truth-telling, accountability. And we're going to model here on Week in Review right now the reality of our lives, which is, while that's a deep and important conversation and it could be all-consuming, there are other huge things happening for us here in the Commonwealth right now. And one of those is the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. And we want to spend a couple of minutes on that. Governor Baker announced yesterday a little glimmer of hope that after seeing some early positive trends in COVID cases and hospitalizations, the state is rolling back some of the restrictions that it put in place back in November.
Effective Monday, January 25th at 5 a.m., the early closure business order and the stay-at-home advisory will be lifted.
So that was a beginning of a change. He did leave in place the restrictions to 25% of business capacity, for example. That will be in place for at least another 2 weeks. Where are you on the pandemic, and where you think we are on the pandemic? Are we beginning to turn a corner? Are you feeling more hopeful? Are you still concerned? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jennifer, Reverend Mariama, none of the three of us are doctors. But what that means is that, like everyone else, we are stuck listening to medical experts, reading the data that we can, looking at the signs, and trying to assess for ourselves where we think we are. So in the arc of this pandemic, Reverend Mariama, today, Where do you feel like we are?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I can say what's happened in my congregation. We've had some folks who've had COVID, some folks who are dealing with pre-existing conditions and so really locked down at home. I think I live in Dorchester, which is one of the more impacted neighborhoods in the city of Boston. But I also found out yesterday that I do have the vaccine. I participated in the vaccine trial. And in
which
order
you
to
told us here on Week in Review.
Yeah,
a few weeks
yeah.
ago.
And so just yesterday they revealed to me that I had gotten the vaccine. And I spent a lot of time, you know, reading what I could before I let them give me an injection. And so, and I'm involved, as is my mother and a number of other Black ministers, really trying to get the word out to folks about why many of us should take the vaccine. I think what's important to note here, and I think it relates to some of what we were already talking about, is it's not that, sort of folks of color are more, inclined to conspiracy theories or anything else. It's that folks of color have lower trust in the healthcare system, and that right. Distrust has been earned by the healthcare system. And so the key at this point is to say to people, yes, we acknowledge that the healthcare system has a long history of injustice in the way it treats Black and Brown people. That being said, while we continue to work on that, we should not deny ourselves the opportunity to have this protection. And so I think it's important that we not gloss over the history of race and racism within the healthcare system, acknowledge it, but in this instance, holding on to that would put us in a worse position because our communities have been adversely, disproportionately impacted by this virus. So there's a lot of us, a lot of folks of color working really hard to lead this conversation in our communities.
So Jennifer Braceras, I think I'd ask you to turn your attention for us to how the governor is handling this right now, both the rollout, where there is some criticism that we're too slow, that the phasing isn't correct, although phase one did entirely open, he opened it yesterday, and the calibration of restrictions that we've seen. How are you assessing those?
Well, I think in some ways Governor Baker has done an excellent job, but I'm very disappointed in the way that the vaccine has been distributed in the state. As Congresswoman said before, we are, I believe, 29th in the country in terms of the speed at which we've gotten people vaccinated. And as she rightly noted, in this hub of the medical universe, that should not be the case. I'm also concerned, frankly, that the people who are most at risk of hospitalization and death from this virus are ninth on the list, essentially, in terms of getting it, and that is people over 70. It is unconscionable to me, frankly, that a healthy 53-year-old like Marty Walsh gets the vaccine simply because he's going to be a federal, officer, a cabinet official, and there are 80-year-old men and women across the Commonwealth who do not live in group settings, who live independently, who are unable to get this vaccine. I find that unconscionable.
So I'm going to grab, believe it or not, time is just flying. I'm going to grab one caller voice here, and then we'll see if we have time to come back more on this. We've got Stephen on the line from Brighton. Stephen, go ahead.
I'll be very brief. One, I certainly disagree with the governor, but I also disagree with your guest speaker because I think the government officials do need to get the vaccine before us. I'm an African-American male. I don't speak for every African-American, but I do agree that we should trust the doctors, trust the experts. I'm not an expert in that field. So trust Dr. Fauci, trust the experts at Boston University, trust them. And as far as the history of medicine and the disproportionate number of African-Americans not receiving health care, go back and read an old book by Harriet Washington, Medical Apartheid. So it's all there. But and last but not least, I think Jennifer does a great job with a word salad. She just, oh boy, she has a word salad. But Jennifer, I really think that the point
Stephen,
is.
Stephen, let's not pick on Jennifer when she's not going to have time to respond because I'm at the end of our time here. You can call in another day and you and she can duke it out.
I
but
like
I'm going to cut
though,
you off there.
Word salad.
There you go. Well, and I am hungry. And I don't mean to disrespect Stephen. It's just we can't engage in that because we're so close to the end of time. And if we're going to do that, I want us to have time to go back and forth. Stephen, thank you for your first point there. I am always amazed at how quickly the time flies when we have so much to cover. And today it's really important, I think, because it has been one heck of a week. I do want to leave a little bit of time here to end with hubbubs, which are local stories or events that have caught our attention, made us think about something else this week. Reverend Mariama, I'll start with you. Do you have a hubbub for us?
So much love to Amanda Gorman, who studied right here at Harvard. And the word is that she used the lyrics of Hamilton to help work through her speech impediment. And also a shout out to the hip hop artist Dessa, who created a Hamilton takeoff about Janet Yellen. It's called Who's Yellen Now? And it's a great song.
Oh, I got to hear it. Can you find it on the Twitters? Is that where I can find
well,
it?
Well, you know what? Marketplace Radio asked her to write it. And it is definitely worth a listen.
All right. Jennifer Braceras, what's your hubbub for us this week?
Well, I love the ones that were just shared. I can't wait to listen to that song. But my hubbub is a shout out to Jen Ellis, a second grade teacher in Vermont, who made Bernie Sanders mittens that went viral the other day. And I just thought that was hilarious. And kudos to her and her mitten making skills.
Yes, those mittens have become the number one meme in America right now. So really cool that you found out who she was and where she was from. That's awesome. Okay, I have a more somber note, but I think it's a bittersweet note. I want to express solidarity with baseball fans around the world today because the Atlanta Braves announced that baseball great Henry Aaron died. He was 86 years old. He did not play for a Boston team, but he was one of, if not the greatest hitters of all time. And as one press release pointed out today, his bio at the Baseball Hall of Fame starts, "Boxing legend Muhammad Ali once called Hank Aaron, quote, the only man I idolized more than myself," end quote. I want to point out that Henry Aaron played baseball in the face of tremendous racism. He started in baseball's Negro League, and he faced death threats as he approached and eventually surpassed Babe Ruth's home run record in 1974. And I just want to give you a little bit of his voice. Here he is reflecting to CNN in 2014 on his experiences as a Black player, and he invokes Martin Luther King Jr., which seemed fitting today during this MLK Day week. Here he is.
I had the world on my shoulders as far as baseball was concerned, but I also had the world on my shoulders to demonstrate to people that, hey, just give me opportunity. But at that same time, you know, if you think about it, you know, Dr. King was marching and the civil rights was at its peak, you know, and we were telling people just give us a chance to drink water out of a fountain or go to the bathroom or go to the anywhere, you know, really. And that all of those things had something to do with the way I was doing it as far as playing baseball.
He was a player of courage, of integrity, legendary skill. I'm sure there are listeners yelling at me that they don't think he was the greatest hitter of all time. I'll go toe-to-toe with you on that. But what I mostly want to say is while he might not have been a Bostonian, we'd have been lucky to have him here. And the world's just a little bit poorer today for his passing. So memories to Hank Aaron. All right, Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester, and Jennifer Braceras, political analyst and director of the Independent Women's Law Center. Thanks so much to both of you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.